Accession number 15450, Reel 1.
Commander Grenfell, Reel 1. Can you tell me how and when you first started to become a sailor, please?
Yes, I was at Montrose Academy in Scotland. I was 15 years of age, and I always had this great love of the sea, and I went to the Prince of Wales Sea Training School, and I did the usual course there. And at the end of the year, 35, 36, I was fortunate enough to be chosen as one of the four best cadets of the year, and I received a Prince of Wales prize. I didn't go into the Royal Navy, first of all, because I wasn't quite sure that I wanted to spend my whole life at sea, and if I joined the Royal Navy, of course, that would have been the case. So I went to the Merchant Navy, and I was an ordinary seaman in the Union Castle Line, an able seaman, and the idea was that I would study for a mate's ticket. Then, in 1936, my father was very, very badly injured in a road accident, and he died soon after. So about 2 years later, I left the Merchant Navy, and it wasn't quite what I thought it was going to be, and I then, at the end of the beginning of the war, I joined the Royal Navy.
In what way was it not quite what you had expected?
Well, the comradeship was not so good, and there was no opportunity for learning. If I'd been had been an apprentice, then I've no doubt that the officers would have helped me a great deal, but I wasn't, because it cost my family enough sending me through the Prince of Wales School. It was a fee-paying school, and they couldn't afford to pay for my training as an apprentice. So I did it myself as an ordinary seaman and able seaman. And because of that, I didn't get all that help, and I wasn't getting very far at all. And then, of course, the business, my father being dying after this accident, I decided I'd go ashore, and I studied at night school ashore.
Had you expected a war to be coming in the late 30s?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, when I was down in South Africa with the Union Castle ships, we met the German merchant ships, and we were together with the German sailors, and of course they are experts at learning languages, and most of them, even youngsters, were able to speak with us in English, and we had a great time with them. And also in Hamburg, and that was the winter of 35-36, we met them everywhere in the sailors' home, and laughed and joked with them, and naturally we read the newspapers, and we knew very well that things were not quite all right in Europe politically. But the people themselves, they were great people, and I personally got along with them very, very well indeed. No, I would say in 1937-38, at that time you were speaking about, I wasn't absolutely convinced there was going to be a war. There was trouble, just that.
How exactly did you go about transferring to the Royal Navy?
No, I didn't transfer. I told you that I left the Merchant Navy, and I was ashore, and I did all sorts of jobs. I mean, my father was dead, and the family were not so very well off. We are one of the less fortunate branches of a very, very well-to-do family, but my grandfather, my father's father, he wasn't very, very pleased about the marriage with the nurse up in Scotland, the nurse who nursed my father back to health again after Gallipoli. And we were left more or less on our own. So I was the eldest of the family, and I had to do anything to earn money. But at the same time, I was going to night school. I studied art, and I studied languages at night school. Now, the transfer to the Navy. The war came, of course, and I volunteered right away. That I did. And I was told by the recruiting officer in Uxbridge, we lived in Uxbridge in those days, and because we'd come down from Scotland, and he told me to wait, that I'd be called up soon enough. And I was. In 1940, I was called up. I didn't transfer. I was called up to the Royal Navy. And that is an interesting thing, because I discovered soon afterwards that many of the Prince of Wales boys, who were highly trained seamen and executive seamen, not specialist electrical or engineering, they were specialist seamen. Many of them became officers right away, RNVR officers, when they joined the Royal Navy. But I joined at HMS Collingwood in Fareham, and there a divisional officer said to me, he looked at my papers and he saw that I was pretty well educated, and he said, "You're just the chap we're looking for to join the new RDF branch." RDF, that was radar. And so he explained all about it to me, and I thought, yes, that's fine. So I became an RDF rating, one of the very first. And we were given a course in RDF, and it wasn't until I was about halfway through this course I met one of my Prince of Wales boys in the street one day as a lieutenant, RNVR. And I said to him, "What's this?" I was an ordinary seaman. He said, "Yes, didn't you know?" He said, "All you had to say was Prince of Wales," he said, and there you had a chance of becoming an executive officer in the RNVR. So I then went back to the divisional officer. I said, "Hey, this is not quite fair. I mean, I'm really a seaman." And he said, "No, I'm sorry." He said, "You're now half trained as RDF, and we cannot undo that." He said, "We spent enough money on you. You must stay as RDF." So I then finished this course, and then discovered to my, well, I wouldn't say my horror, but it was a disappointment, that you could only become an officer in the RDF branch only if you had a university degree in electrical engineering. And I had no degree, certainly not in electrical engineering. And that was the time I started studying, every chance I had, studying, and also when I went to sea later on.
How had you reacted to the news that we were at war with Germany?
A disappointment. I think I was mature enough to realize that it was a very tragic thing. I had met these young German people everywhere, found them to be extremely nice people. There was no aggression, or there was no what we read about now or during the war with propaganda, that they were an arrogant, aggressive people. This may be said about the whole nation, but not individuals. And I liked them, and I found it very, very disappointing indeed. I must honestly say, I was one of the many, not the few, young people. Don't forget, I was only 19 then, who certainly didn't run about in the streets waving flags and saying, "We are going to fight for king and country." Far from it. We just took the information. I was sad about it, but life had to go on, and so it went on.
I think your first ship was HMS Edinburgh?
Yes. I joined her in North Shields, not South Shields, North Shields. And she had just done quite a long refit, and she had been, during this refit, fitted out with the most highly developed long-range RDF warning radar, or warning RDF it was called then. That was my ship, first ship, the Edinburgh. She was a 6-inch cruiser, I believe the largest cruiser type we had in the Navy. There were only two of them built. One was the Edinburgh, the other was the Belfast. The Belfast lies in the Thames by the Tower Bridge.
What impression did Edinburgh make on you when you first saw the ship?
Well, you can just try to imagine a young lad who had discipline in the Prince of Wales School, and also to a certain extent discipline in the Merchant Navy, although not very much. That was probably the first thing that struck me, was the discipline. And I liked it. I liked discipline. I realized it's necessary, and I discovered that I had, in fact, by sheer accident, in a way I have to thank the war for this, that I had landed in the way of life that I really enjoyed most of all, a disciplined, clean way of life. With every opportunity for learning, we had instructor officers on board, and even the higher rank ratings, I'm not speaking about the officers, the ratings, they all had an interest in their junior people, the petty officers and chief petty officers, and you had every opportunity of learning as much as you wanted to. And I liked it.
What kind of duties did the ship itself have at first when you joined it?
Well, after the refit, we sailed up to Scapa Flow, and we were in and out of Scapa Flow, taking convoys across to America. We never actually went to America. We went almost to within sight of America and turned around and came back to Scapa Flow or to Iceland, one or the other. We had the usual attacks, U-boat attacks, and no bombing attacks because we were far out in the Atlantic. And there were several scares, naturally. And then, on the 3rd of March 1941, we were the covering force for the very first commando landing, Lofoten Islands, in Norway. And I must say that this was a strange sort of feeling, because when we went across the Atlantic with convoys, we may or may not have suffered attacks, but we knew when we were going to Lofoten that there was every possibility that we would have heavy attacks, and there was every possibility that the ship would be in action and might even be sunk. But so that was a strange feeling, I must say. However,
any memories from the Lofoten raid?
Yes. Very cold, ice, snow, and we were the covering force, so we didn't see very much of the landing ships. The landing ships were two cross-channel steamers before the war. One was the Princess Beatrix, was one of them. The other one, the name I've forgotten. And we were with them all the time. But then when they were nearer to the Norwegian coast, they dropped small boats, and we didn't see them at all. The small boats went in. We heard a lot of the battle, of course, and one or two German planes came out, but they never attacked us because they could see that we were far too powerful for them to attack us. But they were really concentrating on trying to stop the Royal Marines landing at Lofoten. We brought back, I think, 300 prisoners, German prisoners and Norwegians who wanted to come back and serve with the Free Norwegian Forces. So, in fact, although it was a strange feeling knowing that we were going into an attack, there was nothing very much happened as far as we were concerned.
What's the next thing you remember with your service in the Edinburgh?
We captured a weather ship. The name of it I really forgot. I think it was the München. You would call it the Munich. In München, we captured her. Somewhere in the North Atlantic. Naturally, it was very important because weather reports were being sent back for the U-boat packs. And then we sailed from Scapa Flow around about the same time as the Hood. The battleship Hood sailed. And we went further south. And we knew that the Bismarck had broken out. And we knew that there were supply ships dotted around in the Atlantic and in the South Atlantic. And our job at first was to leave the cruisers at the Denmark Straits. And we went further south. And there we did, in fact, capture one of the supply ships. That was a supply ship, Lech, L-E-C-H. We captured her, and we signaled to the captain that he should... His ship's company should take to the boats, they should not sink the ship, and that we would send a prize platoon or small number of sailors aboard to take over the ship. Our boat was halfway between the Edinburgh and the Lech when suddenly the Lech just blew up. They had in fact placed charges somewhere in the ship, and the ship's company had left the ship on the far side that we couldn't see and had rowed away from the ship. So they were all right, but the ship just blew up. We took the prisoners on board, nice fellows, and we mingled with them. They were kept, of course, in one part of the ship. spoke to them. Everything was very, very friendly. And so it was, whenever we met Germans after that, there was always this friendly feeling between sailors. We were, after all, sailors. Sailors at war.
When you captured the weathership, did that involve anything? Was there any
yes,
resistance?
We landed, we put a number of sailors with an officer on board, but we then pulled away, so we didn't see it. But we heard later that one German had been killed during the very small hand-to-hand fighting on board, and then we took over the weathership and escorted it back. But we didn't escort it all the way. We escorted a certain distance, and then we went to Scapa Flow. What happened to the München later, I really don't know. You could always find out from historical records what happened with the ship. We were really, this was a strange thing, we were not terribly concerned about things like this. We were fighting, and we did our job, and that was it. And none of us ever bothered at the time to follow up what happened. As a matter of fact, the commander landing in Lofoten, we really didn't know very much about it until months and months later. It was done, it was forgotten. But however, I haven't mentioned the next episode in the life of the Edinburgh. We went to Gibraltar, and we took part in a very, very big convoy battle between the British forces and Italian, not German, Italian Air Force planes, and that was on the run between Gibraltar and Malta. And if I remember properly, that was July. The first one was July of 1941. And on that particular convoy, the Manchester was hit and badly damaged with torpedoes. The Fearless was sunk. The destroyer Fearless was sunk. The destroyer Firedrake badly damaged, and she limped back to Gibraltar. And there were one or two other ships damaged by near misses, including our own, the Edinburgh. The engine seatings were fractured, and this caused some trouble. However, we carried on. We were in Malta, and that was during this well-known attack by the Italian Navy on Malta, Valletta Harbour. Much was said about the Italians being not very courageous. It certainly was not the case with the Italian Navy. They were highly courageous people, and they tried to enter Valletta Harbour with one-man torpedoes and with E-boats, and there was a tremendous battle at the entrance of the harbour, and that was the time when the Royal Maltese Artillery did a sterling job, and they beat off this attack, and of course, as far as I can remember, none of the Italians survived. They were all lost their lives.
What did you see of the action yourself?
Well, we were inside the harbour. We just, like all these things, it was night time, by the way, and there was a lot of crashing and banging and so on, but you couldn't actually see it. We were inside the harbour. We were at action stations, naturally. And then we left Malta and came back with a convoy to Gibraltar. There were one or two small attacks on the way, but nothing very much at all. And then we carried on with sailing around the South Atlantic, and then we were called back in September to do another convoy from Gibraltar to Malta. And during this convoy, the battleship the Rodney was hit by a torpedo during an attack. The attacks during this convoy were not so heavy as the attacks during the convoy in July, but both of these convoys were known as the Jaws of Death convoys in the newspapers of that time. We went through to Malta and back again, and that was that. And then we went down to South Africa, to Simonstown, for repairs, to have something done to the engine seating due to this damage from the near misses. And we had the first 3 weeks break in something like 15 months of continual action at sea. We never had any leave at all, and that was the first break. And we were 3 weeks in Simonstown. The South Africans were great people. I'm not the slightest bit concerned about what has been going on in South Africa since. That's a problem which is a unique problem, this problem with the the South Africans and the coloured people there. But during the war, all I can say is that they supported us 100%, South African families and British families down there. They realised that we'd had been in a lot of action, and the families took us out for long weekends, and we had a tremendous time. It was absolutely wonderful. That was the second time I'd been to South Africa. I'd been in South Africa with the Merchant Navy. That was the second time, and I developed a tremendous liking for the South African people. We then left, and this is interesting, we then left South Africa, and it was the middle of their summer. It was round about November of 1941. And we went straight up north to Greenock in the west coast of Scotland. We had a couple of days in Greenock. Then we went up to Reykjavik, or near Reykjavik in Iceland. And then we took one of the early convoys to Murmansk. And that was bad. It was really freezing. We had just come from the South African summer, and there we were in the Arctic winter. The ship was covered in ice, and it's hard to believe, but inside the mess decks, the bulkheads, that is the wall of the ship, there was an inch of ice inside the ship on the bulkheads due to the condensation becoming frozen from the people who were sitting there. Of course, they had to breathe, and this froze on the bulkheads, and we had an inch of ice all over the bulkheads. We never slept in our hammocks. We just lay down with every bit of clothing we could find, covered ourselves over, and we had a little action, not very much. There were a couple of attacks, but they were very minor. I can remember hearing, you see, you never, that's the trouble with the Navy, you never see things close up, and remember hearing that two sailors during an attack, two sailors from a destroyer, I think it was the destroyer Bulldog, they had open gun turrets, and they had swerved in some direction, and a wave had come on board, and two sailors had been washed overboard. Of course, in those conditions, weather conditions, they were dead as soon as they touched the water. And then we went to Murmansk, and they say that Murmansk is an ice-free port. I can tell you that we were absolutely covered in ice, the sea and everything, in Kola Inlet. That's the inlet before you actually arrive at Murmansk. We were absolutely covered in ice, and we stayed there. We didn't get home for Christmas. We stayed there, and some smaller ships came alongside us, and there we were. We made the best of it. We had a sort of a Christmas, and we had one occasion. It is now recorded in a couple of books have described this, how some of the sailors from the small ships had come on board, because we had room on the Edinburgh. And on the Edinburgh we had two aircraft, walrus aircraft, and it was the birthday of one of these people from one of the smaller ships, and they had somewhere or other managed to get in to the aviation spirit store, and they'd made up a sort of drink, and they called it Fly Fly Spirit. And then, of course, the first we knew of it is they were roaring drunk. And one of the sailors died at night time. He first of all complained about becoming blind, and then he died, and he was buried in Murmansk. That's one thing I remember of that particular occasion.
What month have we reached now?
This is December 1941. And then we sailed back, and we arrived back in Scapa Flow, and we were sent to South Shields for our first real refit in 18 months of almost continual action. And that was the time when I left the Edinburgh, very sad, because you become great friends when you're such a long time, 18 months at sea and always on board and in action. Your friends really mean something. So I said goodbye to them, and I went back to Portsmouth.
Had you had much contact with the Russians ashore in Murmansk?
On that occasion, very little. They came on board, of course, the officers, Russian officers, discussed things with our officers. Don't forget, I was only I was an ordinary seaman, then I became an able seaman, and at the time when we were up in Russia, I was already a leading seaman. And so I had very little to do with the officers, but we did see Russian officers coming on board to speak to our officers. And I remember there's one quite humorous thing, and that is that one of the officers, probably thinking that our captain must be an aristocrat and probably had a residence in the country somewhere with a park, presented him with a reindeer. And the reindeer was brought on board, and it was put in one of the cells. You know that all large naval ships have got cells for any of the sailors who are perhaps a little bit naughty from time to time, and it was put in one of the cells. It's a sad thing to say. We had very little food. Don't forget, we were stuck up there, and we had just the supplies we had on board and probably supplies we got from the Russians, and all I can say is that reindeer never arrived in England.
So it was eaten. How did you spend the period between the Edinburgh and your next ship?
I thought that after such a long period at sea and in action, that the people would be kind and say he deserves a leave. I didn't. I think I got 2 weeks leave, and I came back to the Royal Naval Barracks, and I was sent for by a warrant officer who said, "Grenfell, we now have a new sort of adventure. It's called DEMS, D-E-M-S. And you'll find it a thrilling sort of thing to do, because these ships are, or not all of them, but many of them are fitted with a hurricane. They are called sea hurricanes, specially fitted out so they could be shot off by a catapult from these ships. And we're sending you, as a leading seaman, to be in charge of the RDF equipment on board, the long-range air warning equipment, and in charge of the RDF crew. So you should be very proud of yourself."
When you said DEMS, it didn't mean defensively equipped merchant ships.
Yes, it did. So I was sent up to Liverpool, and I think I had about 2 or 3 weeks in Liverpool learning all about DEMS and learning about the type of operation we'd be involved in, and we were quartered in a rather miserable building. If I remember properly, it was called Brownlow Hill in Liverpool, and that was the headquarters of the DEMS. And after this very short introductory course, I was then sent to the Empire Lawrence, and she was lying in Liverpool. Empire Lawrence was quite a large ship, about 10,000 tons, and she had 79Z RDF, which was a very highly developed long-range warning radar in those days, long-range warning, aircraft warning, that is. And she had a catapult and an aircraft. And this aircraft was a normal Hurricane, but because it had been adapted for use at sea, it was called a Sea Hurricane. The ship was not quite finished, so we lay in Liverpool for 1 or 2 weeks whilst we were doing trials, particularly the trials of this RDF, which I was to learn later was one of the most important things on board. And then one day, I shall never forget his name, Sub-Lieutenant Barber, RMVR, carried out the final tests, and he said, "Are you satisfied with the equipment?" And here I was, 22...